the 2004 Nimitz case with the Tic Tac and all that, that could be the new SR-71. And 20 years from now, we could get some declassified documentation saying, yep, that's what it was.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, I am Micah Hanks. Welcome one and all to the program. Glad to have you here as we go spinning cosmogirally through space and time. Glad to be your host as always. Broadcasting to you from the dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains and the dark corner of the web we call KGRARadio.com. And we've got a lot to cover tonight. I've had sci-fi musings on my mind over the weekend. Not only because I've been reading a lot of sci-fi lately, more on that a little later, but right here at the outset of 2020, things are already looking almost like a science fiction novel. That's right, we have the continuing adventures of the Space Force, we have DNA, and the role that's going to be playing not only with relation to the drug industry in the future, but also these websites that can dig up your information about your background. Yeah, we've covered it in the past. We've got an update tonight. Also, some ancient mysteries. And then again, on that topic of science fiction, I've got a conversation that has been waiting to happen on this program for a long time. Eric Wojciechowski is going to be our guest. He's the author of a book that deals with the UFO subject, but not UFO research so much as it involves science fiction and how the UFO idea has influenced us. I mean, the book is a science fiction novel, Chasing Disclosure, but that's really what got me thinking about all of this. Can you write a fiction novel about a topic like UFOs without acknowledging the cultural impact people's belief in actual unidentified flying objects has had? Now, what's really interesting is I think you could be, for instance, a skeptic, as our guest is. He has written for Skeptic Magazine, and he is actually, I think, one of the most intelligent commentators on this subject. He doesn't attach himself to biases, but he's also not a skeptic who discounts possibilities. I think he's right where you need to be in terms of critical thinking. And the UFO topic, let me just tell you, it needs a lot of that right now. No further evidence needed than a quick look at Twitter. But I digress. Now, Eric has written a fantastic novel about UFOs, but one of the things I want to get into with him is, even if you don't believe in UFOs, can you write science fiction about that subject in a way that is instructive to future generations and some of the technological advances we expect to make? Because I think most would agree, good science fiction, especially science fiction that deals with ideas like alien life, it's not about the aliens, is it? And although we'll go deeper into this during the discussion with Eric, it's something that really should be pointed out right here at the outset. Often when we're talking about the search for extraterrestrial life, or UFOs, which some people look at as being possible evidence in support of the idea that Earth has been visited, that's merely one interpretation. There are plenty of others on the table. Again, refer to the episode we did just before the end of 2019, UFOs, Theories of Origin. I think a lot of people these days who are fairly new to that subject, with all the attention it's been getting, might be surprised to learn that, oh wow, there is not among the UFO community any kind of a consensus, any semblance of one, in terms of what we believe this phenomena is. Most people, I think, presume that we're talking about extraterrestrial technology, or that that is the most likely interpretation. I try to be agnostic about it. I'm prepared to accept that even if one day we do prove that UFOs exist, that we get a handle on the phenomenon, that we finally determine what they are, I'm prepared for the possibility that this has nothing to do with extraterrestrial life from other worlds. The phenomena may represent something so far out, according to our current standards of thought, that we haven't even broached that idea yet. We may still be working toward that aha moment. Oh, what if they're this? What if it? And then all of a sudden it just kind of cascades from there. The complex phenomena that we're studying, in other words, may have a solution so simple that we simply have overlooked it. That may sound crazy, but stranger things have happened. If you look at the history of science, more often than not, that is the case. A wide array of complex phenomena. Once you get to that point of discovery, can indeed be easily explained with a fairly simple scientific theory. And in the furtherance of that idea, talking with a friend in academia recently, one of many, by the way, those who, operate in that little obscurist society of academics who work from behind the scenes and whom I engage with quite frequently, you know who you are. It's my hope, of course, in the future maybe to introduce a few of you guys to each other. But again, that's another topic for another time. The broader point is when I talk about this subject with my friends, a few of the themes that tend to emerge are, what if we're going about this problem entirely wrong? What if we have far too many expectations or preconceptions? What if our innate anthropomorphism is really completely getting in the way? What if we're projecting too much of our ideas about being human onto this phenomenon? What if that's part of the problem? And so I said to a friend in a conversation recently, it may ultimately prove that our study of UFOs today will be recognized by future generations as one stepping stone toward a new branch of science. And for all we know, it may have nothing to do with UFOs at all, at that point at least. But again, bringing all of this back together in relation to science fiction, what's got me interested in talking with Eric is, even if you didn't believe in UFOs, you could borrow that theme and you could write science fiction about it, which still, like good science fiction is intended to do, teaches us a lot more about ourselves. Good science fiction, in other words, I think, teaches us about what it means to be human. So I can't wait to talk with Eric about all that. It's going to be one heck of a good conversation. Other things going on. Yeah, iOS updates. I don't know, a lot of you guys probably are already all updated, but part of my New Year's resolution had been to get all my devices updated. And one of the reasons I don't immediately update is, and probably some of you guys out there are like this too, I like to wait and give them a little time to get some of the kinks worked out before I immediately jump on and upgrade, whether it's an app or a plugin or another program I use, or if it's an operating system. I'm a Mac guy, by the way, have been for more than a decade, but I like to give them a little time. I don't leap on those updates immediately. But once the new release comes out, once all of the updates that are needed for the update have been announced, oh, you know what, we've got security issues and patches and things, but now everything's good and now everybody can update. Once the dust settles, in other words, then I update all my devices. But then again, you also still encounter problems like this one. For instance, a lot of the apps I use for audio production don't age very well. And by that, what I mean is that as Mac products are moving steadily into the future and improving visual and audio components and their potential, and everything's 64-bit now, well, all the old 32-bit, and even the stuff older than that, has become obsolete. A lot of those old apps do not work on the new Mac operating systems like Catalina. And that is a little problematic because you find that either you've got to find an all-new app that will perform the same functions, or if you're lucky, maybe the app developer recognized that this was going to happen and they've put out a new version of their product so that you can continue using it. That's always thoughtful, isn't it? But again, you can't expect that everybody's going to do that. And so as we're heading into the new year and I'm updating all of my stuff, by the way, speaking of updates, I believe it was Homeland Security that put out a memo the other day saying if you are a Firefox browser user, that you need to upgrade right now. Stop, drop, and roll, and then upgrade. Like, do not pass go. Proceed directly to your desktop, launch browser, and upgrade. Yeah, they were saying that there was a severe security threat in relation to that. Fortunately, and I'm not a regular Firefox user myself, I prefer other browsers, but I've got to do my due diligence and keep you guys informed. Again, yeah, as we are progressing, and as we're seeing, well, that's another point, more security threats like that in the future, as we are seeing the growth of technology and improvement, inevitably there are going to be some things from the past that don't keep up. And let me tell you, ladies and gents, that's going to affect more of us than just Apple product users, okay? And computers and podcasts and audio production. And a couple of years ago, I interviewed Samuel Arbesman, and he's a technology writer and author of the book Overcomplicated, Technology at the Limits of Comprehension. And it was really interesting to me because the premise that he works with in that book is that if you look at technology not so much as, wow, cool, I've invented something. Look at this new fantastic invention I've made. No, usually you have to think in terms of several smaller inventions that pave the way toward a new invention. Most inventions, in other words, require different kinds of existing technologies. And he had made the argument that if you look at computer technology, if you look at a lot of our engineering that goes into, for instance, the space program, etc., you've got different generations of engineers that come along and work, and people who come into a job and work for different periods of time. Someone may innovate in one field. People may come in and learn how to use that technology, but they may not be able to take it apart. And one of the examples he gives is take a computer, take a laptop computer or desktop, whichever. You'll have somebody who is an expert on building computers, but try asking them to assemble any of those individual components. You know, ask any computer expert who is actually capable of assembling one of those components to take something from another part of the machine and do the same. These technologies are so specialized, and every person is so specialized in each field that the cumulative effort that goes into making things around us work is nothing that any individual alone can produce effectively. And he argues that in a lot of ways, many of the systems that we rely on every day are overcomplicated, which is a sort of scary thought if you think about it, because what happens when those systems fail? Where's the guy that built this? What do you mean he hasn't worked here for 20 years and he's actually dead and laying in the ground? Yeah, a lot of questions about the future, but then I have to think about applying that to the past as well. A great example, of course, is the famous Antikythera mechanism from ancient Greece. We look at that and we have a pretty good idea of what that device did. It was probably used for astronomical and maybe also navigational purposes. And what's incredible about it is it's this unique instance where we only know of one of them, and it seems incredibly anachronistic. It doesn't belong in the era from which it hails. And of course, in those days, there weren't factories, machines, interchangeable parts that were churning out little Antikythera mechanisms every day, at least as far as we know. We've never found another one. This seems to have been a single device that was produced by some visionary inventor. It's the only one known to exist of its kind, and therefore it's quite anomalous, because looking back, we know this thing existed, but we didn't expect that anything with cogs, gears, you know, complicated machinery like that would have existed in ancient Greece. Not until we found it, of course. And it's one of those rare instances where there does actually seem to be a good example of an ancient lost technology. But that kind of thing doesn't happen every day. And even still, although we have a pretty good idea of what role the Antikythera mechanism plays, there's been a lot of study done, a lot written about it, a whole lot of analysis by very qualified experts. But even still, some of the problems we face are projecting our attitudes of the modern era onto the problems people saw from the ancient past. And we can take other examples of engineering and technology. Another great example, and one that commonly comes to mind in discussions like this, would be the Egyptian pyramids. We look at those things and we go, wow, those are remarkable. Why go to all the trouble? And furthermore, if you look at how hard it would have been to lift those incredibly large stone blocks into place, what technology did they have in order to be able to build it? The pyramids alone are only part of the problem. You can't just look at the pyramids, you have to think about all the other things that had to exist for them to be able to build them. And this is interesting because in terms of the overcomplicated nature of technology and the problems that we in modern times face when looking back at ancient technologies and trying to reconcile with how did they do that, it seems impossible, they didn't have the technology then, we could do it easily today, how could they have done it then? You know, all these problems come to mind. There's an interesting correlation that could be made though, because my guess with relation to the pyramids would be that although that is indeed quite an engineering feat, it certainly isn't impossible. If we could do it today, that means that people in ancient times could do it then. Obviously they did. And what probably is true is that there is a much simpler explanation that could answer the complex problem we're facing. And so again, when we look at subjects like UFOs, I wonder sometimes, nothing about the USS Nimitz incident seems to indicate that this is a very simple technology, right? Nothing about the descriptions given by Navy pilots, radar operators, or, you know, the countless civilian and military observers over the decades who have claimed to have seen similar things. Nothing about the operation, the control, and the very nature of the UFO phenomenon appears to be anything very simple, does it? And I don't want to try and argue that it is, but I do think sometimes that perhaps, like our technology, we tend to overcomplicate things. we look to the recent past and we don't fully understand all the things that make the present function. We look to the ancient past and we see engineering marvels and technologies that shouldn't exist but do, and we can't figure out how. We look to futuristic technologies and maybe technology that isn't even our own, and we try to understand how could that possibly be. Maybe all of these things would benefit from taking a simpler approach. And in truth, I think speaking more broadly, we might all benefit from living slightly simpler lives, unplugging from time to time, and not worrying so much about what this person or that person said on social media. There was a big mess over the weekend, by the way. The author of the book American Cosmic, Diana Pasulka, one of the few scholarly writers who has approached the UFO topic in recent years. She was observed on Twitter, allegedly she, we'll get to that in a moment, but she was observed on Twitter over the weekend saying some rather unusual conspiratorial things. I learned about this when my good pal Dr. Pagan tweeted at me and our friend Chris Cogswell over at the Mad Scientist podcast, who we had on the show a few weeks ago, and he had mentioned that Diana had apparently left Twitter after some bullying by some Twitter trolls. As it turns out, apparently there were some very odd things being said by Diana too, but then additional details came out the following day. I mean, I was getting messages from people. Brett Tingley and I were corresponding about this. He said, did you see all that going on last night? It was a little bizarre to watch. Well, Diana comes out and says that she had been hacked on Twitter and that someone had taken control of her account and said all those things. And of course, this led to further debate because the night before, everybody's saying, what in the world was that? The next day, everybody's saying, was she really hacked? Is this whole thing even stranger than that? And honestly, this is one reason I don't engage on social media all that much. I realize I, quote-unquote, should do it more, in that sense of, here are the things you, quote-unquote, should do if you want to brand and promote and all this junk these days. My friends are always saying, do this, you got to get the word out, we got to get this out, we got to get this done, go, go, go. And I want to say, no, 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 slow down. Again, we are becoming overcomplicated. We are so reliant on our technology. And then look at what happened over the weekend. Look at its potential for misuse. Look at the way that that can potentially damage somebody's reputation and good name. Look at the way that Twitter is used by politicians these days. Many would argue that it even has the ability to start wars, because back in the old days, you had to make a phone call or send a letter or an emissary in order to be able to engage between world powers. Nowadays, they just lob grenades at one another on social media, literally tweeting at each other, and then literal grenades may be thrown thereafter. I'm not so entirely sure that all of this technology is a good thing. On the other hand, I don't want to sound like a modern Luddite. I'm not. In fact, it's because I have to work with technology so much, I think, that I'm so hyper-aware of these problems. And honestly, having to work with technology so much, I know what it can do to your mentality. That's right. So sometimes it's good to unplug. And even though we have to rely on that technology to listen to a show like this, it's still good to unplug. So turn everything off, put your phone down, put it on silent, kick back, listen, let's enjoy. Whether you're a live listener or you're one of the many out there who downloads this show on the podcast. That's right. Let's all just take a deep breath, relax, and disengage, at least for the next couple of hours. Nothing blue about this Monday, right? Actually, that reminds me. You know, Lauren was tweeting over the weekend that Forbes had an article about this. Blue Monday, they say, is pseudoscience. There is nothing, and I'm actually reading from the Forbes article here. There's nothing scientific or factual about the third Monday of every January being the most depressing day of the year. They say the formula that calculates this is utter nonsense, and over the years, there have been some great meme-brimming articles further clarifying the fact that this Monday is no more or less statistically or verifiably depressing than any other Monday. Heck, I kind of look forward to Mondays. I mean, I enjoy what I do. I enjoy engaging with folks like you and doing this program. And Monday, although it's my craziest day of the week, I never find myself one of those people sitting there on Sunday nights going, oh God, but I sure did when I was a kid. I think a lot of us did. And it just goes to show there is indeed a time, a day of the week that is bluer than Monday. And that's Sunday night for anybody who's got to go to school the next day. Yeah, been there, done that. Okay, stepping over from the Ministry of Truth Affairs and bringing you an update in relation to what we covered last week with the Space Force. We have this item from the Federal News Network, and they report that the Space Force is getting together what it plans to do, and it's preparing to present to Congress this plan for how it's going to become the next military service and what exactly it's planning to do. As all these things are coming together, and by the way, keep in mind that February 1st is the deadline for the new Air Force Secretary to deliver this to Congress. But Federal News Network here reports that Major General John Shaw, leader of Space Force's Space Operations Command, said that the new service is building itself for the far future. Talk about looking ahead with technology, that's exactly what the Space Force is doing. And really, maybe even more than a lot of us anticipated. He said, "This is a huge opportunity. We have the opportunity to create a warfighting service from scratch." He said this apparently on Friday at an Air Force Association event in Washington. And I quote him here, he said, "I've been telling the team, don't think about a warfighting service for the next decade. Create a warfighting service for the 22nd century. What is warfighting going to look like at the end of this century and into the next?" Now, they say that that also may include, wait for it, interplanetary operations. Shaw goes on to say, "Technology will change on the fly, maybe even by the second. What we see is code writing that used to take years that now takes weeks or even hours. That will actually be done in microseconds, and maybe artificially. It's going to be highly technology-dependent and not human capital-dependent." So those are among the things they say that the Space Force is looking at. In addition to, Shaw having said, "We have to bring balance to the Space Force. It's a different domain. The physics are different." Anybody else catch what sounded like a Star Wars reference there? Bring balance to the Space Force yet again. And we're going to talk with Eric Wojciechowski later about this. You see how science fiction is not only influencing our lives and our projections for the future, but even the future of combat. There you have General Shaw talking about how wars in space may be fought in the future, maybe interplanetary. He's obviously referencing Star Wars, in other words. And yes, our ideas, whether they are science fictional or rooted in the at times very overcomplicated science and tech of the real world, those things all have bearing on where we're headed as team civilization and the innovations of the coming decades. Exciting, but also at times maybe a scary time to be alive, which is why we try to assess all of this on this program. Monday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. It is the Micah Hanks program, and we'll be back right after this. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. You know, in line with what we were just reporting about the very futuristic objectives of the U.S. Space Force, we also have this from space.com. The first rocket launch of 2020 by China's space agency apparently was a mystery payload. They report that state-run media and independent analysts have been making different claims about the goal of this mission. Chinese media said a Long March 3B rocket sent a satellite into space from Zhejiang Space Center in the Sichuan Province, southwest China, that is, at 10:20 a.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday. A lot of questions about what exactly this payload might be. Of course, keep in mind, NASA did the very same thing with a mysterious aircraft that was in orbit for a record-breaking amount of time just last year. We're all playing this game, right? Everybody's keeping an eye on what everybody else is putting up there in the air, which, I mean, quite obviously, there is always that lingering concern, that sort of threat, as evidenced by stories like this one. Maybe you heard about what happened in Canada, sort of a repeat of what happened a few years ago in Hawaii. That's right, Canadians throughout the province of Ontario apparently received an emergency push alert early on Sunday morning about a nuclear incident in the city of Pickering, 30 minutes outside of Toronto. Now, you could only imagine. In fact, many of you out there, Canadian listeners, don't have to imagine. I'm sure you experienced this. This was probably quite scary. The alert, they said, applied to people within 10 kilometers of the Pickering Nuclear Generating Station. And while it said no abnormal release of radioactivity from the station, people who got the notification, understandably, were terrified, according to Science Alert, until at least some got a second notification more than an hour later that it had been a mistake. That's right, the emergency bulletin had been in error. The initial alert, Science Alert reports here, was sent to cell phones at around 7:30 a.m. and advised that emergency staff were responding to the situation, but that people nearby did not need to take proactive actions. However, officials confirmed by around 8:30 a.m. that the alert had been sent in error. Some alert recipients got another notification after 9 a.m. that said there is no active nuclear situation that clarified the error. Not quite on par with what Hawaiians experienced, right? You know the incident I'm talking about, where they received a text message saying, take cover, basically, that there was an impending strike. Not the kind of thing you want to wake up to, huh? And of course, a lot of folks up there in Canada no doubt felt very much the same, very frightened when this information comes out and then later they are told, actually, there really is nothing to see here. Which, in cases like that, that's certainly good news, but it really makes you wonder about our alert systems. Systems which, if an accident like this occurs, actually may have as much potential for danger as any kind of an incident itself. Anyhow, a couple of more news items here before we get to some listener emails. Oh, and I've got a lightning strike update I want to work in here too, but Lauren had sent along this very interesting story from Live Science about this unusual orb in this painting by Leonardo da Vinci. And no, it's not the Mona Lisa. The painting we're talking about is a depiction of Jesus Christ in Renaissance-era clothing, and he's raising one hand in blessing, but he's holding this unusual-looking clear orb in his left hand. And as Live Science reports, that orb defies the laws of optics, creating a controversy over just what Da Vinci was using as his inspiration. UFO technology? Probably not, but again, the question remains, what is the technology? But a group of researchers think that they may have figured this out. The paper is presently pending peer review, but apparently a preprint of this, which was made available online via an academic website, has disclosed what a group of researchers at the University of California, Irvine, believe the painting depicts. And they say that the mystical-looking sphere, the orb that is being held in the left hand of Christ in this painting, probably actually was representative of an actual object, and that Da Vinci had a model holding it, if indeed the object were made of a very specific substance. Anybody want to guess what that is? Whoever said blown glass, you may be right. At least that's what these researchers from California believe, but not everyone agrees. Now, Live Science reporting on this notes that the paper is unlikely to settle the long-running debate over Da Vinci's intentions, and one of the key critics of this idea that the model had been holding a blown glass sphere is Martin Kemp, who is actually emeritus professor of the history of art at the University of Oxford's Trinity College, and, as all you fans of Da Vinci's work out there will know, he is an expert on Da Vinci and his paintings, and he had this to say about this paper. He said, the paper about this sphere is just one of the many examples of scientists making ill-judged interventions in Leonardo's studies based on ignorance of the sources. So the good professor certainly doesn't seem to be on board with the idea. Now, if you want to look at the painting I'm talking about, if you head over to the Googles, look for the Salvatore Mundi. This is the famous painting in question. And as Live Science reports, the orb held by Christ in that painting contains a few painted sparkles, which again, according to some, look like inclusions within a solid sphere or crystal. However, the problem is a solid orb would magnify and invert the image of anything behind it due to the refraction of light, and the orb in the painting doesn't do that. Christ's robes appear undistorted behind the glass. So why is that significant? Well, because in addition to being a fantastic artist, we also have to take into consideration some of Leonardo's aptitudes for technology and for invention. He was essentially a polymath. He was multidisciplinary, and he happened to be one of those rare individuals who was good at just about everything that he did, including his study of optics. And so art historians argue that Da Vinci would have known how to correctly portray what that glass would have shown from the perspective of the observer looking at the painting. He wouldn't have made that mistake. And so some have argued that either one of two things had to have happened. The orb being held by Christ in the painting is not what it is interpreted by some to be, or we have to also look at the possibility that there was an intentional misrepresentation on part of the artist. And as they report here at Live Science, art historians have been arguing for decades about this. They want to know what the orb was made of and whether Da Vinci deliberately painted it inaccurately. So this new paper brings a method called physically based rendering to the question. UC Irvine computer scientist professors Michael Goodrich, Shuang Zhao, and doctoral student Marco Zhanghong Ling use this method to simulate light in the scene that is depicted in the painting. And here's what they found, that a combination of dim environmental light, a strong light source from overhead, and a hollow blown glass sphere actually could recreate the scene in the Salvator Mundi. They were even able to calculate the approximate thickness of the glass of the sphere that he would have been holding. Pretty amazing, huh? If, of course, they are correct. And I'll have more to say about that in a moment, but I want to come back over to what Martin Kemp had to say, because he's written a new book that addresses this, Leonardo's Salvator Mundi and the Collecting of Leonardo in the Stuart Courts, Oxford University Press, scheduled for release right here in 2020. And Kemp argues, very much in line with, I think, the artistic interpretation of the painting, look, not only was Da Vinci very interested in physics and light at that time, but it is known that in other paintings that he did, he tweaked certain things. Live Science reporting on this, they say he lists examples, Kemp does, of paintings in which Da Vinci tweaked the laws of physics and light to create a more pleasing composition. In paintings of Baptism of Christ, for example, the painter and his contemporaries skipped depicting the refraction of light and water that would have made the figure's legs look skewed. And for a simple example of what they're talking about, take a clear glass tumbler, fill that halfway with water, and then put a fork or a knife or a spoon down into the glass, because I know none of you guys are using plastic straws anymore, remember. That's right. But again, if you look at the way that the object appears as it passes through the air and into the water at the base of the glass, it will appear as though the object is skewed, right? Well, Leonardo would have known this, but he didn't depict things that way in paintings, nor did other Renaissance artists, because it was more pleasing to the eye to play with the laws of physics. And herein is a very interesting argument, because there is that scientific literalist interpretation. Well, we have to account for what appears in the painting, even if it doesn't make sense. And so it's one of two things. Either that orb existed as depicted in the painting, or Leonardo was wrong. Well, let me ask you this. Was Jesus really standing there when the painting was made? I mean, seriously, it's a fair question, isn't it? No, he had a model. Artists do that. Did every Renaissance painter who depicted St. George battling the dragon actually have a big green dragon breathing fire there? No! This is part of what makes art unique. It's the imagination. And if I had to guess here, just going off of a hunch, are the scientists more likely to be correct here or the art historian? My money is on the art historian. I think Da Vinci was quite capable as an artist, and if he wanted to make something look mystical and magical, he probably could have. In fact, in this case, I certainly think he did. We got one more news story. I think I'm going to save that for the final segment of this hour. I want to get to the lightning strike update here before we go to the break. So we reported recently about a site in Scotland where it's an archaeological site involving an ancient stone circle. Okay, a megalithic stone circle, and there's evidence of repeated lightning strikes in the center of this stone circle, and so some of the archaeologists were making the argument that perhaps ancient people were drawn to that site and erected this stone circle around a location where this lightning strike anomaly had occurred. Recently, and this is quite interesting, the Seven Ages guys and I had the opportunity to talk with a archaeologist from Ohio, Jared Burks, PhD. And as I was doing the prep for that interview, I noticed he had actually authored some science papers about lightning strike anomalies at ancient archaeological sites in Ohio. And we talked with Jared a little about some of his research involving these lightning strike anomalies and how he uses remote sensing technologies to be able to locate these at archaeological sites. Here's what he had to say about lightning strike anomalies in relation to archaeology and the article about that that we touched on recently here on this program.
As you probably know, when lightning happens, there's a lot of current that flows around, electrical current. And when electricity flows, it creates a magnetic field. So that's what's happening in this case. Electricity is flowing between the ground and the sky. And as it's flowing through the ground, it's creating a very strong magnetic field, and that's permanently magnetizing the ground around it. And so it's not burning the ground. It's magnetizing the ground through this electromagnetic process. And so electricity tends to flow, in the path of least resistance, literally. Apparently for a lot of lightning strikes, that means pretty close to the surface. And the reason we know this is because a lot of these magnetic anomalies that are created in the soil by the lightning strikes, and they're kind of long and narrow, mm-hmm. and they line up with the path of plowing in these agricultural fields.
Oh, okay.
So it's pretty easy to see because I can detect the plow marks in the magnetic data, and then B, you see these lightning strikes and they're lined up on the same path. That they must be traveling near enough to the surface that whatever the plowing is doing to enhance, the ground for electricity to flow. And I suspect that it's funneling moisture, down into the bottom of the plow furrow, and electricity likes to flow through that moisture.
Right.
It's got to be fairly close to the ground. So one of the things I've noticed over the years, I've had the chance to work a lot at a place called Hopewell Culture National Historical Park. Mm-hmm. It's in South Central Ohio. There's some big earthwork sites there, Hopewell Earthworks, and various components of the park were assembled from old agricultural fields. And as soon as they were purchased, they were taken out of plowing, and plowing stopped. And one thing I noticed was it seemed like some of the parts of the park that had been parked longer had more lightning strikes in them. And the newer parts of the park had fewer lightning strikes.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, I wonder what that means. And then it all kind of came to a head when I was doing some survey work at a site called the Junction Group Earthworks. It's one of those sites that the community banded together and helped to purchase back in 2014. And once it was bought, I went out there and did another magnetic survey. So I'd surveyed it first in 2005 and 6, and that's the results of that were so compelling. That's what we used to convince people this place was worth saving, because you couldn't see it at the surface at all if you're standing out there. But it was clear as day in the magnetic map. Uh-huh. So there was obviously something still there underground. And in the new magnetic map, so this would be not even 10 years later, there was a new lightning strike that wasn't there the first time I had surveyed it. Mm. And this new lightning strike was lined up with the direction of plowing. So it had, it had hit and followed one of these plow marks. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, I wonder, at first I said, well, why did it travel that way? And then, it dawned on me, oh, it's following the same path that the plow marks are following. And so then I went back and started to look at other data sets that I had. And it's like, hey, look, all these other ones, they also follow the direction of plowing. And there was another site there within the park, Hopewell Mound Group, where there were two fields side by side, and the plow direction was different in each field, and the lightning strikes were oriented differently in each field to follow the plow marks. So, when you do enough of these, eventually you realize, that's no brainer. I mean, the pattern's very consistent. So that's a good sign. And then when you start looking closely at these sort of intact lightning strikes in the magnetic data, and you study them a little bit and figure out what makes them tick, their shape and how magnetic they are and how the magnetism changes with the distance from the point where the electricity came into or left the ground. And then you think about how deep they are and how long this has been happening, right, for thousands of years.
It
stands to reason that plowing has also probably destroyed a gazillion of these things, and that maybe it hasn't completely destroyed them. Maybe there are little parts of them that are still left. And we often find these kind of large, inexplicable magnetic things in some of our surveys. And As I started looking at those, I was like, oh, you know what? Those are the remnants of lightning strikes that haven't been quite erased by plowing. So they're maybe a little bit too deep, you know, to be hit by the plow. So, that's what the lightning is all about. Now, the question you're probably thinking is, well, did they build these earthworks, you know, right where the lightning was striking? I'm sure you guys live in areas where you have thunderstorms and you have lightning, and you know that some of those storms get pretty busy with lightning, and it is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard about the story you mentioned over in Ireland, that this site that had, I think it had two lightning strikes. And one of these earthwork sites in southern Ohio that I surveyed, it has like 100 lightning strikes.
Wow.
Now, did I get all excited and go to the BBC and say, my God, they built this earthwork to conduct electricity? No, because there are lightning strikes everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I would say to those researchers, I didn't read the BBC article, so maybe they addressed this, but I would say, have you surveyed outside the earthwork or the stone circle or whatever it is?
Important.
You know, to see if there are other lightning strikes.
If you'd like to hear that entire interview, that's in the most recent edition of the Seven Ages Audio Journal. All those podcasts are freely available at sevenages.org. I also want to say, if it sounds there at the end like Dr. Birks is being a little too skeptical, I don't think that's what he intends by any means. He's simply asking, again, if you notice an anomaly where there appears to be a lot of strikes within this megalithic stone circle, to me that is very interesting. But it's fair to ask, if you were to look outside that stone circle and you found other lightning strike anomalies, perhaps an area 12 feet outside the circle and off to the right somewhere where there were even more lightning strike anomalies occurring, would that make the one inside the stone circle less significant? I think that's the point he's trying to make. Interesting discussion, and we will continue this one with some listener emails when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Keeping you company as we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. I am Micah Hanks, glad as always to be here with you guys, and looking forward to our discussion with Eric Wojciechowski a little later. Now, right now, I do want to get to a few listener emails, and then we'll wrap up our news segment shortly after that. Jocelyn writes, Dear Micah, I enjoyed your discussion a few weeks ago from 12/30/2019, the eve of tomorrow, about the varied legal implications of AI development. And she says, in particular, as you briefly mentioned, humans will have to decide how the law will treat AI entities if and when they commit crimes. Should AI entities be treated like humans in the eyes of the law, even if they aren't, as you say, meat sacks like us? Their combination of intelligence and objectness challenges our neat division between human and non-human. This paradox reminded me of the pre-modern British legal category of the deodand, from the Latin Deo Dondus, that which is given to God. From about the 11th century until 1846, objects and non-human things that directly caused the death of a human being, like a stone falling on someone's head or an ox kicking someone to death, had to be forfeited by their owners to God, represented by the monarch. This was a way of making sense of how non-human actors can, in fact, do things just like humans can. That's really interesting. She also notes, interestingly, the use of deodand law ended in 1846 because owners of railroads did not want to forfeit their expensive trains in the event of a death on the tracks. The Industrial Revolution thus launched a new understanding of objects as unresponsible actors, a view that we still hold today, but which the rise of AIs is now challenging. Really interesting point, Jocelyn. Thank you. And she goes on to say that she really loves the show. Hope you have a good 2020. Thank you so much for your email. Craig also writes, Micah, once again, let me say that when I am able to break away from my busy schedule, one of my favorite pastimes is listening to your podcast. A couple of hours of good entertainment every time without fail. Now, as you mention on your show from time to time, the UFO subject is the gift that keeps on giving. Yes, Craig, and in more ways than one, my friend. But I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir. He says, and sometimes it is more important to observe the reporting of the subject than the subject itself. Perhaps more to the point, we have to take note of what is not discussed in the UFO circles among the ufologists over what is. And he says, take for example the incident reported in the conventional news outlets around Thanksgiving of last year. And this he links in the email, a Washington Examiner article about something we did cover on this show. In fact, I think I even touched on it on the Middle Theory podcast too. And it involved a scare in Washington where there was what appeared to be a large object, maybe an aircraft, moving over Washington. Now, Craig points out on the surface, this was an incident with many similarities to the famous 1952 Washington UFO incident, which is a major waypoint in the history of UFO investigations, both official and unofficial. And just as it was in 1952, in 2019, military officials came to the conclusion the quote-unquote UFOs witnessed were in actuality just anomalies within the detection system. And they weren't something nefarious or out of this world. Now, he says, your friend Tyler Rogaway detailed the incident for The Drive, giving his usual detailed sound analysis and links to an article there from the War Zone that Ty wrote about this. And here in his email, Craig quotes Ty, saying, quote, this should be the final takeaway. No matter how advanced a mechanical system or the larger architecture it is embedded with may be, it has the potential to be imperfect, unquote. And yes, that is a very important point that you make right there. Craig continues, I would offer another takeaway from the incident, not with respect to the nature of air defense over the nation's capital, but in regard to the way the UFO field handles incidents like this. No ufologist, self-proclaimed or otherwise, as far as I can determine, has mentioned this incident. And given the prominence of the 1952 incident, this is both troubling and surprising. The November 2019, I should point out that I covered that story, but I didn't, of course, explicitly present it as evidence of a UFO encounter. And a lot of people were touching on the story in the news at that time, but I think, again, Craig's fundamental point is we haven't seen ufologists making the case that this is good evidence for a UFO over Washington like what we saw in the 1950s. So he continues, given the prominence of the 1952 incident, this is both troubling and surprising. The November 2019 incident, given its reporting in mainstream circles, should have been a short topic on the podcast and radio shows at a minimum. We should have seen some mention on blogs or other outlets, but we didn't. Instead, a repeat of the same breaking stories from the last 2 years, Bigelow, Tic Tac, and the USS Princeton. Maybe I'm wrong and I missed some reporting over the holidays, but I do try to follow the field closely, if not completely. And I haven't noticed so much as a whisper mention of the Thanksgiving 2019 incident. Again, I have to agree, there's probably a little too much reporting on all that other stuff you mentioned. I'm kind of tired of hearing about Bigelow and the like, and even though I've talked a lot about the Nimitz incident myself, I think it is in the furtherance of understanding the historical implications of a case like that, which, if nothing else, is important because of the cultural impact that it has had. There's been a lot of interest in that subject, the USS Nimitz incident. And also, of course, we have to take into consideration that that incident represents information about a technology that at the current time has not been identified. It may be, and who knows, in the future we may have a whole different perspective about the Nimitz incident, but for the time being, if it remains unidentified, and if we are looking at the, and this is key, the possibility that there may be some unidentified technologies in our midst, then this case may historically be looked back at one day as being a real turning point. But we shouldn't leap to that conclusion. And really, maybe it's just a New Year's resolution of mine, but I'd like to report a little less, if I can, on the Nimitz thing in the coming months. You know, we've covered it on this show, but I think that point has been made. And if you'd like to hear more about it, you don't necessarily have to listen to this show. There are plenty of other podcasts that are continuing to discuss this, and ATIP, and Bigelow, and all these other subjects. It's like, guys, you know, there was a UFO research community before all of that. I'm pretty convinced there will be one afterward, too. And we might benefit from looking at things a little more broadly. That's all I'm saying. But coming back to Craig's email here, he concludes saying, the technical takeaway I would offer here is that if 2019's version of the DC radar system is such that anomalies occur, then we certainly cannot hold the historical antecedent system of 1952 to a much higher standard. With respect to that 1952 incident, we often hear tales of radar operators stepping out of their shacks to see the flying saucers, other ground-based observers corroborating the sightings, or jet interceptors locking onto targets that suddenly disappear. Yet when pressed for names, places, times, and particulars, none are handy. In the case of 2019, we have places, times, and particulars. The individual names, of course, would be redacted for security, but the official organizations are named. And yet clearly, as Rogaway detailed at his article there at the war zone, this was a system anomaly, not some actual intruder. If our modern system allows such imperfections, the 1952 system would also. And thus we should place far more scrutiny than we do on these accounts from 1952, which in our present conversations often seem more apocryphal than factual. In short, we have to ask why the speakers in the UFO community avoided discussion of the 2019 incident, even while scarcely a week passes without one of them trumpeting the 1952 incident as evidence. As always, keep up the good work. A devoted listener, Craig. And thank you so much, Craig, for making that historical parallel. I think that it's really important to look at technology we have today. And although it may be different from what we had in the past, to further Craig's point, if what we have today is an improvement upon what we had decades ago, and yet we still see problems, the technology is imperfect. And if imperfections are interpreted in certain ways, we can see what that leads to. Yeah, we should definitely look back at some of those classic cases. Isn't it interesting that from the 1940s up through the 1970s, we have so many good UFO reports, and many people these days would say we don't have as many good UFO reports, barring, again, a few exceptions like the Nimitz case and things like this. But I know I've argued that, and Nick Redfern has made the same argument. It seems like from the 40s up through the 70s, I mean, UFOs were just dropping out of the sky, and people were seeing them all the time. Now, is that because there was a serious survey that Earth was undergoing? That after we launch nukes at the end of the Second World War, and that puts us on the universal radar, and they're coming and scoping us out and assessing whether there's a threat, and they're conducting field surveys and abducting people and taking soil samples. I mean, is it possible that that was occurring from the late 40s up through the 70s? And then after around 1973, we start seeing things taper off a little bit. Well, maybe. But there's the other interpretation too, right? That maybe the technology back then was far less sophisticated than what we have today. And as our technology improves, interestingly, we might make the historical argument that we see a little less in the way of the quote-unquote good UFO reports. It doesn't mean that there aren't any, but it definitely means that we can weed out some of the ones that we would have looked at a few decades ago and said, see, flying saucers. New technology, in other words, as it improves, seems to both help us weed out the unlikely cases, but also it gives us more data about the good ones, like the Nimitz case. So anyway, thanks to all you guys for writing in. If you would like to write into the program, I always like to hear from you. info@MicahHanks.com is the best way. You can also follow me on Twitter @MicahHanks. Oh, and I'm on Instagram too. And in fact, if you go on there, just search for Micah Hanks, you'll be able to find me. I've noticed with the popularity of the Hellier series, that's right, they've got the second season that just dropped recently. And with the popularity of that series, I definitely get a lot of inquiries from you guys out there. And from time to time, people even write in asking, hey, can you tell me how to get to that cave? It's all fun stuff. Trust me, wait until the weather's nicer. Maybe we'll take a hike, right? Maybe I'll get a group of us together. We'll all go up there. See, now I've stepped in it. Now that I've said that, I'm going to get even more emails from folks. But anyway, one more quick news story before we get Eric Wojciechowski on the line. And this one has to do with the company 23andMe. And Lauren brought this to my attention again in the furtherance of a broader discussion I think we've been having over the course of several months now. This reported by New Scientist, they note that DNA testing company 23andMe has sold the rights to a new drug that it has developed using its customers' data. It is the first time the company has signed a deal to license a drug it has developed. Now, they say the deal for the drug, which is being investigated as a potential treatment for inflammatory diseases, is with Spanish pharmaceutical company Almirall, according to the company's vice president of business marketing, Emily Conley. She says this is a seminal moment for 23andMe. I'd say so. She also says we've now gone from database to discovery to developing a drug. Now, that's interesting, but I can't help but wonder, are there going to be some controversies that emerge from a company that collects genetic information from individuals, and then they produce drugs, presumably based on that information? And again, even if they have not explicitly compromised any one person's information, information that people provide to them in confidence is being used in this way. I mean, is that in the user agreement? I'm presuming probably something must be. Now, They actually address that in the article. They say 23andMe's terms of service state that by signing up for testing, quote, you specifically understand that you will not receive compensation for any research or commercial products that include or result from your genetic information or self-reported information. Interesting point. And I think another question maybe that could be asked here is that really fundamentally what the company is all about? Are they doing this service that allows people to find out, you know, things about their heritage? Or are they collecting that information and doing that, but in the furtherance of producing drugs and other things that they can market and sell? Food for thought, maybe. All right, we're going to be joined by Eric Wojciechowski right here discussing UFOs and chasing disclosure on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back, enjoying ourselves on a Monday night like we always do, and my, how the time flies when you're time traveling. Indeed. Want to remind you guys, of course, as always, if you head over to MicahHanks.com, the official hub on the web that we occupy, where you can find all of the podcasts for this program, and you can also subscribe to the podcasts. You'll find articles, you'll find all kinds of other information, links to the other podcasts that I produce. Remember, there isn't just this one. There's Middle Theory and the Seven Ages Audio Journal as well. And of course, if you would like to become a subscriber and get additional content to this program, we have the X Podcast for subscribers, which features additional commentary from yours truly and from our guests. And of course, the monthly Enigmas special. All of that is available right there at MicahHanks.com/podcast. Or at our legacy page over at GraylianReport.com/X. So let's dive right in, because we've got a lot to talk about with our guest tonight, Eric Wojciechowski. And he is a fellow who I've wanted to talk to for a long time. He is a commentator on a number of topics ranging from philosophy and atheism, sometimes politics. He also talks about UFOs. He's written for Skeptical Inquirer, and he joins us on the program right now. Eric, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you. You know what got me thinking about getting you on the show involves something else that you do. You are a writer of fiction, and you had written a book, I guess it's a couple of years ago now, Chasing Disclosure. It deals with the UFO topic, but I am a longtime fan of science fiction. And for me, fundamentally, science fiction, especially when it deals with the idea of aliens, really is performing one fundamental function, I think. It's trying to teach us something about ourselves. Would you agree?
Yeah, there are some things that are like that. Some stories that are basically like the alien reflects something about ourselves that we don't want to accept. And then there are some that are just for fun. Like, for instance, I would think like the Star Wars universe is just on surface. On the other hand, you could go with Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces and that's going with a mythology. So, yeah, I guess all science fiction would sort of be a confronting the other.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to get into a lot of the questions about what many would advocate as being a reality in relation to UFOs. Your approach from a science fiction perspective was interesting to me, though, because for me, Eric, UFOs wouldn't have to exist at all. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. We're still, I think, really trying to work out that problem or understand exactly what we may be dealing with. But for me, if it was proven that there was no such thing, that this was all just somehow a creation from our minds based on misperception, what's really fascinating is they undeniably have influenced human culture and the way that we think about technology, the future, and so many other things. So I do want to ask you, bringing the science fiction perspective to this, what got you into wanting to write about UFOs from that perspective?
Well, my interest in the subject goes all the way back to when I was a kid. In fact, when I meet somebody and they tell me that they don't know anything about UFOs or Bigfoot or the pyramids of Egypt, I always wonder how they spent their childhood, because that was mine.
Yeah, me too.
And my father was into that. In Search Of was big in the 70s, and he would talk with his friends around the campfires, and I would sit there and listen. So I was always interested in that, and it started mainly with the ancient astronaut theory, which today would be the ancient alien theory, which was the subject that possibly extraterrestrials had visited man in his past, and our mythology and legends reflect those visitations. So that stuck with me for a long time. Now, the way that the fiction side came in was through H.P. Lovecraft, which I think every ancient astronaut, ancient alien theorist knows Lovecraft, whether they read him or not. It's the concept of these ancient beings who came to Earth, who manipulate man either in their dreams or their technology or their societies, and they control things in the background. And you see this, in fact, on Ancient Aliens, the commentators, the people that discuss this, they talk about how they're still with us and managing us and so forth, possibly. So you take this interest in UFO topic that my father had talked about, and you mix it with Lovecraft. And when I entered college, I suddenly got the interest in learning about everything. When I was in high school, I goofed around like any high school boy would. But then in college, all of a sudden, I got into my psychology classes. I got interested in mysteries, and I went to my local library, and I picked up a book by Philip Vandenberg called The Curse of the Pharaohs, which discussed that when the Tutankhamun's tomb was opened, a number of people that were witness to it had passed away suddenly, unexpectedly, and so forth. And the book was examining whether or not there was a real curse, whether or not it was a disease, radiation or whatever. So it started me thinking, well, if this is correct, then maybe there was something to ancient man knowing more than it did, and if so, where did it come from? And you get the Atlantis starts to seep in, the ancient astronaut theory starts to seep in, and then I start, I'm reading Lovecraft at the same time. So the next jump is what? Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods, right? And that's probably where it started. And then I'm interested in the pyramids of Egypt, and then a friend of mine who was into astronomy, he says to me, Eric, they found these pyramids on Mars. And I said, you're kidding. And he leads me to Richard Hoagland's book, The Monuments of Mars.
Oh, yeah.
And I devoured that probably in a week, I think. And I was hooked pretty much ever since. And so getting to the question about why fiction and UFOs, for me, was that at a certain amount of time when I study a subject, I think this might apply to everybody, but when you read about a subject enough, you finally come to a conclusion where you have to draw a conclusion. You're like, well, now is the time where I have to decide what I think. Maybe you're spinning your wheels, you've learned all you can, now it's time you've got all the data, put the puzzle together, what do you think? And I wanted to contribute something to this field, except when it came to something nonfiction, I felt like I was just regurgitating all the same books that you'd already seen.
Sure.
Running through the same UFO cases, running through the same ancient mysteries and out-of-place artifacts. And, I didn't want to write something that people have read. I've read ancient alien books, and they keep regurgitating the same thing. So I wanted to do something different. So I said, all right, here's what I'll do. I'll take what I know, and I'll create a fictional universe with characters in it, and I'll sort of do like what James Cameron did with Titanic. You create fictional characters, but you tell the story. So if you read my book, Chasing Disclosure, you should get a basic idea of the UFO phenomenon. And then you'll get to go with these fictional characters to a conclusion of not what I truly think is going on, but what I thought would be a really great ending as to what is going on, at least in the novel.
Yeah. And I want to get with you a little later about what you do think is going on. But, first I have to point out too, we might as well have been separated at birth because your origin story is so similar to mine. Literally sitting around a campfire. I think it was more my mother, but my father had a lot of books about these subjects. And that got me interested early on. And you may have heard me tell this story, so I won't belabor the point, but I had a very interesting experience when I was in third grade, and my teacher, I'd written a report for class about UFOs, and she was very science-minded and very skeptical, and I really appreciate that now because although at the time I've kind of laughed about this over the years, that she had, I think, given me a B and said, you know, good reporting, but the subject, you know, there's just no scientific evidence that supports this. It got me early on. Of course, I first thought of that as a challenge, but as time went on and I've reflected on that experience more and more, you know, it's really, I think, that point where I began to realize if you're going to make extraordinary claims, you do have to have good evidence in support of them, which brings us to the topic of archaeology, because you obviously are very interested in that. I may have read that same book about the curse of the pharaohs that you're talking about. It would have been about eighth grade for me. And it got me thinking along the same lines. You know, Professor Ken Fader would probably call this the mystical inclination a lot of people have toward archaeological subjects. Unfortunately, that not only is often incorrect, but it sometimes does a disservice to actual archaeology. And yet I think maybe some could be confused by the fact that you've got someone like myself who is a proponent of the idea that UFOs should be studied, but who doesn't relate those things to the ancient past and to archaeology. Where do you come down on all that?
Yeah, well, you know, I started with von Däniken, and which led to Zachariah Sitchin, and, you know, the ancient astronaut theory. I always say that I got my degree in the ancient astronaut theory the same time I got my degree in psychology in the university in the early 90s. I was reading those books along with my textbooks when I was working towards my degree. But then what happened was, it's almost embarrassing to admit now, but I don't mind doing it. I remember being so convinced that Sitchin at least had a good theory that it should belong in the history section of the bookstore. And I said this while I was working at a bookstore to some people. We were in the New Age section. That's where this stuff used to be. And I said, you know, have you read Sitchin? He's so good. We should put it in the history section. And I thought that just sort of saying that out loud was sort of like, you know, why isn't it in the history section? So I started reading mainstream archaeology, and I started seeking out experts, and I started literally writing letters. In fact, I regarding the book Forbidden Archaeology by Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson, back in the 90s, I wrote to Ken Fetter, and we had a couple letters exchanged back and forth regarding that. And I also worked, the guy who worked in the bookstore with me, he was a Mesoamerican archaeologist. He didn't have any grants to work there at the time, so he was at the bookstore until that stuff came through. And he was constantly irritated with me because I'd be asking questions, and he was like, he would encourage me to read, and he would give me books to read, mainly on his subject matter, Olmecs, Mayan, Aztec, and so forth. And so I did. And I got those, and I realized that that when it comes to the ancient astronaut theorists, they're masters at cherry picking. And when they quote a myth or a legend, sometimes they're not even quoting the original myth or legend. They're quoting some interpretation or something that was interpreted 200 years ago when we didn't even understand the language very well.
Right.
Or they're interpreting a medieval text, which was a forgery right off the bat. And they're using this as evidence. Or they're simply, if they do get to the original source material, they're truncating it. And it looks like it until you read the whole thing. And then you're like, oh, I see what's going on here. And then you start discovering that the wall starts falling and pieces are missing. And whether or not – I actually ended up the same place Carl Sagan did back when he wrote – I believe it's called Intelligent Life in the Universe in the late 60s or the 70s, where he examined the ancient astronaut theory. And if we had a visitation in the past, we'll probably never know about it. Because all the evidence offered for the ancient astronaut theory pretty much amounts to zero. We've learned a lot more in the past 100 years, and we know where things come from. We, like, regarding the pyramids on Giza, we have practically diaries from some of the people that worked there saying what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So no aliens needed.
Well, you know what's interesting, Eric, is you mentioned Sagan. Sagan had been interested, of course, in the idea that maybe what I think he called in the book you reference, and in others, I think he wrote about it in Broca's Brain as well, and a few others, but he would have referred to this as paleocontact. And he said, look, maybe we should look at archaeological evidence and historic evidence. Let's see if there's a good case to be made that maybe Earth was visited. And then he eventually came around and said, after reviewing that evidence, I don't see a compelling argument. Now, again, I'm a guy who, like yourself, I'm really interested. I have a whole separate podcast I do that deals explicitly with archaeology and not fringe theories in relation to archaeology. I mean, we interview real archaeologists, tenured professors, people who are out there in the field, and people who are educated, highly educated on this subject matter. And the big takeaway one often has, I feel, I know I have, is that there's not any convincing argument that can be made in the absence of a contrary argument, which offers a better scenario in terms of interpreting the past. That doesn't mean we don't still have some questions, but there's usually a more sensible way to relate to it that involves a human component. Now, I would also say if we look at a 13.5 or so billion year old planet and the short amount of time that humans have occupied this Earth, if we were visited in the past, it's far more likely in terms of probability that those, you know, contact events wouldn't have ever occurred when humans as we know it existed on Earth. We might have been visited, but that doesn't mean that humans were here to actually receive them. The welcoming party, in other words.
Right, that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, it's just a very interesting interpretation. Do you ever get pushback from people, though? Because having written, even if it's science fiction, and obviously, I follow you on Twitter, I see that you're interested in the UFO topic. Do you ever get feedback where people are like, okay, wait a minute, hold on, how can you be interested in this but not think it's that?
You mean, how can I write a book where there's a genuine phenomenon, but in real life, I don't think it's that?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, that's easy. That's like if I were Stephen King trying to convince people that Pennywise is real, and yet I'm, you know, just trying to tell a story. Yeah. It's like I can tell a story with science fiction using a real phenomenon, but I don't really quite believe it. You know, there's a lot of horror stories with demons and so forth, but the author doesn't really believe that. I guess where I trip up with people that I talk to is that I didn't just write this story because I thought it was fun. It's possible there's something more to it than misinterpretations or so. Perhaps there is an intelligence that's messing with us and we don't understand it. And so I'm open to that possibility, but I'm willing to also say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I get into trouble, because some people will say, well, if it's not this, it's not this, not this, and not this, it must be this. And I'm like, well, no, we might just be missing a piece of evidence that could be coming someday that will answer it. For instance, like if you're a detective working on a cold case, some of these murder mysteries or whatever, they go decades unsolved, and then all of a sudden DNA evidence or somebody speaks in the prison and they get evidence, and all of a sudden it's solved. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's okay to say I don't know. And writing fiction may have gotten me a bit into trouble, because since my conclusion was sort of in favor of something mysterious going on, I think some people read that, they're like, oh, he's a believer.
Right. That's what I've been wondering. If you are a skeptic who writes science fiction about a universe where UFOs exist, do they accuse you of being a closet believer? But also, more fundamentally, if you allow for the possibility, as I think Eric does, and we'll get into this with him, if you allow for the possibility that UFOs exist, can you still be a skeptic about ancient astronaut theory? We'll ask him about this and more when we return here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. I am Micah Hanks. Our guest tonight, Eric Wojciechowski, is the author of a science fiction novel about UFOs, Chasing Disclosure. And we are discussing with him not only science fiction, but also skepticism, the UFO phenomenon, a lot of different things, a lot of different topics on the table tonight with our guest. Of course, keep in mind, when we post the podcast for this episode, we will have the complete show notes where you can find information about Eric's work, his books, and other things discussed on this edition of the show. Now, getting back to where we were when we left off, we've been talking about whether or not you can write fiction about UFOs and be a skeptic. I mean, obviously you can, but I'm sure that there are people who would say, oh, come on, deep down, you've got to be a believer, right? Now, do I understand correctly that when it comes to UFOs stepping from fiction and over into real life, that you are open to the idea that maybe there is some reality, whatever it may be, to this phenomenon?
Yeah, of course. You know, if you want to study a subject like ghosts or Bigfoot and UFOs, you're really going on stories, anecdotal evidence. Mm-hmm. You can't really formulate a scientific theory based on that. You need something more. So I have no problem collecting stories. That's, in fact, what I did with this book, Chasing Disclosure, and I told a story. But we need more than a story to actually create a theory. So I have no theories going on. In fact, when it comes to the so-called, quote, phenomenon of UFOs, I'm not even sure that there really is a phenomenon in UFOs. For instance, let's say Rendlesham Forest and Roswell and Socorro with Lonnie Zamora, the case, and Lublock Lights. Let's say that all those are completely separate incidents, and one of them is experimental military aircraft, the other is birds at night caught on light, the other was some college students playing a prank. You see what I'm saying? There's no actual phenomena. It's just the only thing in common was something in the sky. I think when some people say UFO phenomena, what they're talking about or what they think is happening is that there's one entity, one thing happening with all these different, like an octopus with all these tentacles, and the tentacles point back to the octopus. I'm wondering if the octopus even exists at all.
Sure. That's a fair question. Now, you know, I'll add too that now also should probably point out, I don't want to ever come across to my listenership as being some guy who will, well, if I'm talking with a skeptic, I'm going to be more skeptical. If I've got Stanton Friedman on the show the next week, which would be very difficult since we lost Stan last year, yeah. But, you know, yeah. I spoke with him many times. And again, I use him as the example because Stan was all in on the idea that not only is there a phenomenon, it is explicitly extraterrestrial. You know, I wasn't really 100% with him on that, but I'll explain why in a moment. I want to very clearly express to folks that I am of the mind that I think that we should be open to the possibility that there is a real phenomena here, and some of the data forthcoming about some of these high-profile cases like the Nimitz incident could represent that, but there are multiple interpretations of what even that, albeit very right. ambiguous video, right? I mean, it leaves a lot to the imagination, but there are a lot of interpretations of what that might be. So I understand where you're coming from when you say that, you know, this could represent many things. And in fact, when we say UFOs or ufology, I don't even like that term really anymore. Mm. I feel like we do need to point out that what we're studying really has a lot more to do with human perception of a wide array of different phenomena that can be perceived as unusual things in the sky. And at times, sometimes maybe.
Right. There. I can't remember the date, time, or even place, but there was a case where some people sent up, Chinese lanterns, mm-hmm. and then they recorded the sightings. They recorded the sightings that came in, and people were seeing all kinds of things, triangles, saucers, and so forth. And yet, the people who launched them knew exactly what they had launched. So the human perception was, what do you see? What do you see? What do you see? What do you see? And all and so forth. And there were all these different things. Now, if we didn't know where this originated from, we would think, or some people would think, this was some kind of intelligence messing around and giving people interpretations, whatever fit their psyche or something. But we know that it's completely terrestrial. We know that it was a few pranksters, in fact, who were actually just trying to find out what they could, you know, see what people could see. And this happens all the time. A lot of times, you know, people will launch things in the sky and, you know, it'll be misinterpreted. My interest probably is in why some people think that it's an extraterrestrial, especially if they think that it's a higher intelligence and the purpose of that sighting was that they were communicating with them. Like, what led you to believe that as opposed to, I saw a light in the sky, I don't know what it is?
We should break down some things there too, Eric, because again, one issue I have, even if we were to step into the idea of a sort of pro-UFO mode of thinking, why do people necessarily gravitate toward extraterrestrial? Right?
Yeah, well, you could probably go back to the 1940s, you know, 1947 when all this started. We just got done with World War II, and we had a Cold War brewing up, and we had technology unlike we'd ever had before. We had a lot more experimentation and aircraft. So it really is hardly a surprise in the 40s and after World War II, people were seeing things in the sky. They had no idea what they were looking at. You know, and then a little bit later on, you had the U-2. And all these other experimental aircraft that were going even higher than commercial aircraft, and the CIA wasn't going to tell them what was going on. So the commercial aircraft were reporting things thousands of feet higher than what they were flying. And at the time, if we don't have it, somebody else must have it. Yeah. And if Russia doesn't have it, at the time was our only competitor, then it must be from somewhere else. So, it, you know, like Donald Kehoe would argue, it must be extraterrestrial because we don't know what it is. We now know a lot of that stuff was just black ops. It's now been declassified, the U-2 and SR-71 and so forth. Once again, what it boils down to is just because you don't know, some people jump to extraterrestrial. I generally will say, wait for more information. And those who have waited, now things like the U-2 and SR-71 are declassified, we're like, oh, that's what it was. Yeah. That's what was going on. You know, so now we know. The Nimitz that you mentioned, the 2004 Nimitz case with the Tic Tac and all that, that could be the new SR-71. And 20 years from now, we could get some declassified documentation saying, yep, that's what it was. So, you know, people who say that, well, because it's not ours and it's not Russia and it's not China, it must come from something else, either interdimensional or outer space. Again, I'm saying, look, it's okay to just say, I don't know. It's okay.
I think sometimes that skeptics, and again, you being a writer over the past how many years now for Skeptic Magazine, you've contributed a number of articles.
Well, Skeptic Magazine, I got my first published in 1998. Mm-hmm. Skeptical Inquirer has only been in the past few years. I've had now two published, and I've got a new one coming out in the March-April edition, which will be the next issue. Mm-hmm. Skeptic, that was, we can get into that, but that was my examination of Zachary Sitchin.
Yeah.
So I've been writing on and off and reading, but only in the past few years have I really said, all right, I'm going to start writing, and I'm going to take a mystery that I'm interested in. I'm going to research it, write my findings, and then see who wants it. And so far, Skeptical Inquirer has been good to me. They've taken my articles lately.
Well, I think that really is good. And, you know, I do want to get into some of your background writing for them. You have a couple of great stories, too, about not only getting a phone call from Michael Shermer, somebody who I really respect, but also reaching out to Zachariah Sitchin. But first, one of the points I wanted to make was I do think sometimes that, you know, especially for people who might be in the pro-UFO camp, I kind of straddle the fence only in the sense that I'm trying to examine it critically, but not discount the possibility that we might be dealing with a phenomenon. But then again, you make a very good argument, and trust me, it's crossed my mind several times, that even with things as incredible as what we hear about with the Nimitz incident, we cannot exclude the possibility that there are earthly sources for that technology. We just may not have enough information right now to be able to make sense of this. But again, Carl Sagan, in his fantastic book, The Demon Haunted World, talked all about UFOs and about our high-altitude spy planes and things, and how at times those were mistaken for being unidentified flying objects. So coming at this from the perspective of a person who is an advocacy of UFOs, I think that a critically minded skeptic sometimes gets a bad rap because they would perceive you, Eric, as being someone who says, look, I don't believe, it's impossible, it doesn't, and there are some skeptics who kind of take that attitude. You are simply saying, look, there's a difference between saying, I hear all kinds of stories of interesting things, they're interesting stories, but science doesn't work that way. We really need to work with evidence. So what evidence do we have?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, I'll get attacked because, okay, you mentioned in the beginning that I've written articles on atheism and religion and so forth. I'm not as active in that community as I used to be because I think I kind of, you know, examined what I wanted to. But I'm getting the same flack from that type of work as I do from this type of work, which is you're sort of poo-pooing somebody's favorite theory. But not so much theory, but if I'm writing that all the evidence ever offered for the existence of God amounts to zero, I've just really upset somebody. Now, the new gods seem to be extraterrestrials because one thing I've noticed, which is very interesting about the atheist community, is some of them, they give up on the old religions, but they're into things like astrology or extraterrestrials. And I'm not saying into it like I'm into it, which is just the subject matter. I'm talking about they've replaced the old gods with the new.
Right.
And they're not necessarily joining UFO cults or Heaven's Gate, but now they're watching Ancient Aliens saying, yeah, that might be it.
Oh, yeah.
So what happens is if you have an invested belief, if you, you know, and you think this is exactly what happened, if you're really invested, this is in politics as well. If you have an invested political persuasion and somebody not necessarily attacks it, but questions it, you don't see it necessarily as an attack on your belief. You see it as attack on you personally.
That's true.
So if I say, hey, there's no such thing as flying saucers with aliens, to some people, that's almost the same thing as saying, hey, you know, there's no evidence for God. What they see me, they almost interpret that as me saying, you're stupid. Mm-hmm. For believing this, which is not at all what I'm saying. I'm just saying that there's no evidence for it. So if you believe it, why don't you try to convince me? And sometimes they try to.
Yeah. Have you ever read Jonathan Haidt's book, by the way, The Righteous Mind?
I have it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, it's a great book, man.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately a bibliophile where I collect more than I read, and I've got five things going at once.
Same here. And in fact, I haven't even finished John's book. I've got to actually commit to getting through the last third or so of it. But again, the book is, and actually you could read just probably the first couple of chapters and get the fundamental takeaway. But that's what he argues, is that really, you know, the tribal nature of what the way that humans form groups based around belief systems and then attack each other or feel like any kind of discussion that contrasts with their belief system, preconceptions, etc., they perceive it as an actual attack. And that contributes to a lot of the fighting these days, which I think is unequivocally amplified by social media. And one more reason I have to be so careful on Twitter these days. I know you know what I'm talking about. To doubt an idea and to discuss that with someone who advocates it does not mean I'm attacking that individual, but many perceive it as such.
Right, exactly. That's the problem that I run into, is especially if somebody is really invested in an idea, whether it be political or UFOs and aliens or religion or something, if they're really invested, what they've done is they've tied their ego into it. Their family may be involved. They all go to church and so forth. And if suddenly I say, hey, there's no God, all of a sudden they're thinking, wait a minute, you're telling me I'm stupid because I'm wasting my time. Or, there are no flying saucers with aliens, so you're being foolish. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, where's the evidence?
Yeah, you have to ask those questions. And one question I know I want to ask Eric Wojciechowski about when we come back after this involves an interaction that he had with an ancient astronaut theorist, the late Zechariah Sitchin. And this is after Eric underwent his own conversion to a more skeptical mindset on these things. I'm going to ask him about that and more when we come back right here on the Micah Hanks program. From the high mountains of Appalachia, I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. Continuing our conversation with Eric Wojciechowski. He's the author of the book, Chasing Disclosure. We have links to that available in the show notes for this episode. But Eric has an interesting history. He's met a lot of the guys who really, I think, were fundamental in shaping the ideas that we know today as ancient alien theory or the ancient astronaut idea. Before we get to that, I also want to mention there is a forthcoming collection of short stories, I believe, that Eric is writing that are based in the same universe as Chasing Disclosure. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I'm working on right now. I'm hoping to get it out by spring or summertime and have it available by fall. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, keep me in the loop, of course. We'll have to talk about that Certainly. A little too. Before we went to the break, I'd mentioned that, you know, I'm very interested in the UFO phenomenon. I try to approach it skeptically, critically minded. I do think that perhaps there is some evidence, especially recently, that warrants further investigation. We should, suspend our judgment, but proceed with caution and I think really look at some possibilities in relation to this. That's where I stand on UFOs. I also think that a historical analysis of not only the topic, but people's belief systems related to it would be very useful. I hope to do something along those lines here in the future. But if we go far enough back in time, Eric, again, we see the claim that, well, not only was Earth visited in ancient times by astronauts, but that this phenomenon, the idea of ancient astronaut theory, represents the beginnings of the UFO phenomena we know today. It is, in essence, a continuation of something that began a long time ago, according to many ancient astronaut theorists. Now, what's funny? I've met Eric von Daniken, spoken with him several times. I think you have too. And Eric, if you talk with him, he has said on a few occasions, at very least, he's told me personally, he doesn't like ufology. He thinks that the UFO buffs are doing terrible disservice to the ancient astronaut theorists. And I would argue some of the UFO researchers would look at ancient astronaut theory as being essentially the same thing, something that does disservice to UFO research. But I think that what is difficult for some is to say, if you're someone like me who advocates, research into that topic, UFOs, but you're also interested in archaeology, how could you not be interested in ancient astronauts? For me, I don't see a connection there. And I know that for you early on working in that bookstore and reading the works of Zachariah Sitchin, this was part of what led you away from looking at ancient astronaut theories as being legitimate. Let's talk a little about your reading of Sitchin, why you kind of fell out of step with him and where that led, because there's a fascinating story behind this.
Yeah, what happened was after reading von Daniken back in probably 1989, I suddenly wanted to just gobble up everything. All right, I wanted to find more. Like I've mentioned, I read Richard Hoagland's Monuments of Mars, and I came across Zachariah Sitchin's 12th Planet. And the 12th Planet, basically the premise there was about 450,000 years ago, an alien race from a technically 10th planet in our solar system, he counted the sun and the moon, so that was where the 12th comes from, had come to Earth, had manipulated mankind, created a slave race out of the existing ape creature, and created Homo sapiens to do its bidding. And the myths and mythology and legend that we have today are a reflection of that time. And they were still here probably around the time of Alexander the Great. So we're going to about, 300 BC? Mm-hmm. So we're talking 445,000 years of existence on this planet, and disappearing only a few thousand years ago. So because I didn't know any better, I was still young. I was 19 at the time, 20. I was getting into college. I was finally starting to get into academics. Prior to that, I was a kid in high school, just messing around with music and so forth. I didn't care much for it. So it was really easy without context or a proper education to accept this. I couldn't read Sumerian or Egyptian or anyhow. So I started reading it, and then I read his second book, The Stairway to Heaven, and then the third book, The Wars of Gods and Men, and then I read The 12th Planet again and so forth. And I started reading some more, but Sitchin's work always seemed to be the best and so well documented to me. As I mentioned before, working in the bookstore, I said to somebody, this should be in the history section, which of course led me to examine why it wasn't in the history section.
After being thoroughly castigated by your friend there, right?
yeah, he was a Mesoamerican archaeologist who, he wasn't on a grant at the time, so he was finding part-time work until that happened. So I was lucky to have met him because he steered me into the path of academia in that.
Yeah.
But at the time, I also joined the Ancient Astronaut Society, which was run by Gene Phillips out of Chicago. Him and his wife. And the Ancient Astronaut Society was basically Eric von Daniken. Gene Phillips had created it based on von Daniken's work to create a group, like MUFON or so forth, but for an ancient astronaut, mm-hmm. For von Daniken's theories. And I joined that, and I got their newsletter. In fact, I own every single one from the time it was originally published up until the time they ceased publication in 98, except for one, because I ruined it with spilling a cup of coffee or something on it. But anyhow, as part of being a member of that group, they had a phone book, and you were allowed, if you wanted to, you could opt in or out. You could put your address and phone number in there for other people in your community to contact you. So you could create local groups and meet up at pubs or coffee houses or whatever, and you could discuss these things. So I opted in. I didn't have anybody to talk to much about this. I was reading books. This was before the age of the internet. There was maybe chat groups, but I didn't have a computer until the mid-90s. So this was like 1990, 1991. Mm-hmm. then I quit working at the bookstore. I went into my permanent career, and I was still reading this stuff. And one day, in about 1996, I got a letter from a member of the Ancient Astronaut Society. And she had sent this letter to a number of us and said, Sitchin's work is really good. Let's talk about it. Let's find the pros and the cons of it, and let's create study groups. And the questions in that letter I thought were interesting because I replied to her, and then I started getting really detailed, detailed to the point where I had actually, my reply was basically saying Sitchin is wrong. That simple. And I took a lot of reasons why I thought he was wrong, that his theory was wrong. One in particular was the fact that, as I said in the beginning, if these guys, if these extraterrestrials were here 450,000 years ago and they were around as late as the time of Alexander the Great with space bases, we would know it. We would find the remains if they'd only been gone for 2,000 years.
They would
years.
Have
There's
to.
No doubt about that.
They must have left something behind. And by the way, just to make sure we understand our chronology here, so this was after you had kind of had your conversion, but you're still subscribing to their newsletter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. I subscribed to the Ancient Skies, which was the newsletter, until they closed. In 1998. And mainly it was because Gene Phillips was just reaching of age and he wanted to retire and just simply vacation or something with his wife, which, with the last remaining years. Mm-hmm. So that they shut it down. And I believe it was Giorgio Tsoukalos who picked up the baton with that. Mm-hmm. And created what is now, I can't remember what they call their group now, but it's basically the ones responsible for Ancient Aliens. So, so the Ancient Astronaut Society was the precursor to what you see with Tsoukalos' group, as far as I know. But so, yeah, so I wrote this letter back to her basically saying, I don't think Sitchin's right. I don't. And my reasoning. And then I kind of looked at my letter and I said, you know, if I just worded this instead of to this person, if I worded it to a readership, I could turn it into an essay.
Yeah.
So I did. And I sent it to Skeptic Magazine. But before I sent it to Skeptic Magazine, I thought, okay, I'm going to send it to Sitchin. I'm going to give him the courtesy of seeing if I'm in error. I don't want to misrepresent his work, so let me do him the courtesy and send it to him first and see what he has to say, because if I'm wrong, I'll just drop the whole matter. I sent it to him, and he replied to me with what amounted to like almost a sticky note, and it said, from the desk of Zachariah Sitchin, and he basically said, I'm returning this to you. This was before the days of email and so forth, so it was a hard copy in a manila envelope, and he returned the whole thing to me, and with this little note that basically said, I'm returning this to you unread. I don't read or comment on anything unpublished.
Okay.
So that's when I decided I'm going to give it a go, and Skeptic Magazine picked it up, and Michael Shermer called me. And he called me to tell me they were picking it up. And I was really just excited. This was my very first article. This was actually I said 1998 earlier, but it was actually 1997. And he calls me to tell me about it. I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. And they publish it. So it's in Skeptic Magazine. And I call up Michael Shermer when I get my complimentary copies. And I say, thanks so much. Looks awesome. Thank you for giving me the opportunity and publishing it. I said, by the way, Sitchin told me he doesn't comment on anything unpublished. And Shermer goes, well, send him a copy.
Yeah.
Which I didn't do. I'm like, you know, if he didn't want to comment before, he can deal with it later because now it's out there. But I still actually have all those letters from Sitchin, and they're up on my website. I've scanned them in, including the original letter that was the basis for my essay. As far as I know, unfortunately, Sitchin passed away and never mentioned it, because I've yet to find anywhere he ever addressed my complaints.
Well, you know,
so I don't know if he. Yeah, I don't know.
It's such an interesting story to me. It also, I mean, I think that there's some instructive elements to it, but to make a very long story short, it's interesting to me because you gave him the benefit of the doubt, and you sent him the message or the actual article, and said, "Look, would you like to comment on this before I publish it?" And, you know, these days, something I often see, I guess, in the online community is this sort of gotcha culture where it's like we've got to surprise everybody with these attacks and make everybody look as bad as we possibly can. You know, whereas to the contrary, you weren't going after Sitchin and trying to attack him. You were saying, I have some problems with his theories, but I'm not going to resort to ad hominem. I'm not going to pick on him, make fun of him, try and belittle him. And then blog about it and surprise attack from behind. I mean, you gave him full foreknowledge and he still declined the opportunity to read the article and then apparently never commented on it after the fact.
As far as I know, he never commented. Perhaps he did. Yeah, and I missed it somewhere, but I mean, for me, my interest is in what's going on. It's mm-hmm. not about personalities. Right. I'm interested in ideas. If I see an article by Micah Hanks, I'm going to read the article and judge that, not because it's Micah Hanks, okay? Or an article by Carl Sagan or, something like that. It's going to be the meat of the article because what we want is we want not authority, but we want good evidence. Mm-hmm. So just because somebody comes out like a Neil deGrasse Tyson and says something, well, don't necessarily accept it because it's Neil. If you've got questions, talk to not only Neil, but talk to other astronomers if that's what the issue is, And then you can get a consensus. Like I said, when I was into the ancient astronaut theory, I didn't just stick with ancient astronaut theorists. I didn't just bounce stuff off of the group in the Ancient Astronaut Society. I was talking to archaeologists and saying, hey, how did they do this? How did they do that? And so forth. And they would tell me. And I was like, okay, well, you use Occam's razor. What's more likely?
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Sitchin is as far as I know, he never read it. I think he passed away 2013, so I'll never know. It's kind of a shame. But yeah, I'm interested basically in ideas. I'm not interested in just trashing the guy. So.
Sure. And, again, full disclosure, I actually love this side of the story because how you and I met had been you had written a review of a anthology that I contributed an article to a few years ago. Yeah. And, you'd probably been more critical of certain other essays than others. And mine was right there in the middle because it was an essay addressing how science can better be applied to ufology. And, you conceded some good points and also said, but, here are the problems I had with what Micah wrote. A lot of my co-authors on that anthology, I think that they looked at that review and they were like, this is just a skeptic attacking us. And I was like, whoa, we need this. This is good. I think I reached out immediately and emailed you and said, thank you. And that's how we came on each other's radar. But again, I would expect anyone, a friend, a colleague, whomever, if they want to raise conjectures intellectually about something I've written and argue points in the merit of my argument, I mean, I fully welcome that. I appreciate, however, the scholarly and frankly, the gentlemanly way that you go about that. And that's, again, full disclosure, folks, that's actually how we met. So, and here we are today.
Yeah, that's true. I remember reading it and deciding because it came to me and what I like to do is with a lot of nonfiction books, I like to do reviews. Mm-hmm. I like to do book reviews. That's part of what I like to do. I don't review fiction because fiction is subjective. I'll give stars if I liked it or not. But when it's something like a UFO book or a history book, I'll try to give a review on what I thought. And that one was UFOs Reframing the Debate. Mm-hmm. And that one had a whole bunch of essays. And some of them I thought were really good. And some of them I thought were reaching. And I can't remember what I said about everything. But yeah, some people weren't too happy with me. But hey, I don't know. Maybe if I had a chance to reread it and go over it, I'd say something different. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's okay to disagree, don't you think? At what point did it get to a point where you had to agree with everybody all the time or you can't be friends?
Right. But it's also it's funny because sometimes I'll write things and a year later I'll be like, I don't know about that. And I'll review it thinking, and maybe I'm like, that was really bad. I don't know why I said that, because of course you change your mind or maybe you were in a certain state of mind when you read it and so forth. So yeah, I suppose I'd have to go back and look at that review, but that's in the past. I try not to.
yeah. Well, but now that's admirable too, because Eric, I'll point out, I think sometimes there is this attitude that if I've said it and it's in the record, then that has to for all time be what I believe. And if someone points out something is wrong about it, or if they disagree, then I've got to double down and find a new way to continue to make that same argument. You see people on the skeptical side and on the belief side in relation to UFOs or any other topic doing that. And sometimes it's humbling when we have to express that we might have changed our mind about something or may have been wrong in the past, but it is sometimes warranted. But again, in relation to that, review, no, I don't think you need to go back and rewrite it. I stand by everything you said.
Yeah, a lot of people are like, well, you know, this is the way you feel and so forth. For some reason, you can't accept this. I'm like, wait a minute, you got to understand something. I was raised Catholic. I believed the Catholic side of things. I was originally an ancient astronaut theory believer. I had to undo all that. And now I'm on this side. And I'm on this side because of either evidence or lack of evidence. So I have indeed changed my mind. In fact, I went from believer to unbeliever, which might be harder to do.
Oh, yeah.
I'm only speaking from my own experience. So, So anyhow, that's the Sitchin article. And in fact, it got picked up in the Skeptics Encyclopedia. I can't remember the full name. The Encyclopedia, Skeptics Encyclopedia, is a 2-volume set, and it's still available as a case history. So it's there.
Wow, that's fantastic. Let me ask you this, and this is kind of unrelated to a lot of what else we've discussed, but I think it's nonetheless relevant. A lot of folks, especially right here on the cusp of the new decade that we're approaching, the 2020s, it's going to be the roaring 20s all over again. And rather than being automobiles, you know, and a booming economy, a lot of people are saying, you know, it's going to be artificial intelligence and flying cars. Do we need to slow our roll? Are we a little ways away from that futuristic Blade Runner-esque vision that we thought would, oh yeah, be here 10 years ago, but still hasn't arrived? What are your thoughts about the future?
I'm not educated in that, in the sense that I don't know. I mean, I've read a lot of fear-mongering, but I've also read a really good book. I believe the author's name is James Barrett. It's called Our Final Invention. In fact, quick thing, it was that book and some information in that book that gave me the idea where to go in my book, Chasing Disclosure, on what was going to happen.
Oh, really?
I read that, and James Barrett's Our Final Invention, where he interviewed a whole bunch of people involved in AI who basically said, in a nutshell, if we do this, it's probably going to be our final invention because it will take over, not a Terminator type way necessarily, but it will, we're going to have it farming, we're going to have it driving our trucks, we're going to be putting people out of work because the machines will take over doing those jobs. They're going to get so good, you know, 50 years from now, we may not have truck driving as an industry. The machines will do it. And then I've paid attention to essays and the work of Sam Harris, who has argued that AI might be a problem in the future because of this very reason. Mm-hmm. But then again, I've also looked at the other side of some people who are working AI and say, that's just fear-mongering. That's just, they don't really understand what they're talking about. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope we're not headed for the Matrix.
Something tells me we probably aren't. But, you know, again, that's part of the reason I asked is, you know, that you incorporate some of those elements into your fiction writing. And again, I think if we have so many questions about the future, we're searching for alien life. You know, we're not sure what kinds of intelligence will be here in the course of the next decade or what other kinds of, you know, hurdles perhaps or maybe advantages humanity will face. One of the best ways that we can engage this, I think, is creative thinking and also, of course, you know, trying to maintain a critical mindset. And you do that not only with your blogging and your commentary and publications like Skeptic and Skeptic Inquirer, but of course also in your science fiction. And I'm looking forward to some more of that here in the future, maybe a little sooner than the end of this decade. Huh? So, Eric, where can everybody find your information online?
Well, if you want to go to my website, that's where I've got a lot of my articles. Where I've got my atheism articles, my religious critique, New Testament critique, as well as my UFO stuff, links to Skeptical Inquirer, the stuff that's public, as well as some of my fiction, which has been public. You know, you can find it all there. And then my blog, which I'll comment on from time to time, just something that interests me. That's at ericwojo.wordpress.com. So it's ericwojo at wordpress.com. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter. I'm more active on Twitter. And that's just at Eric Wojo. I happen to get that handle before everybody else. So there's Eric Wojo's 1234 and so forth. But I am just Eric Wojo.
Excellent. Well, Eric Wojo, thank you for joining me here on the Micah Hanks program. And I certainly think that this will be the first of many conversations. This one was a long time in the making. Apologies for taking so long getting to you, but thanks for being my guest.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, it was wonderful talking to you.
Absolutely. And we'll do it again sometime. But for the time being, that makes this show a wrap. And thanks to Eric Wojciechowski again for being our guest. Thanks to all of you guys out there who tune in every week and make this show possible. This program is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control in Ogden, Utah are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.